This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, February 23rd, 1954, children from the Arsenal Elementary School in Pittsburgh received injections of the new polio vaccine. The polio vaccine was developed by Dr. Jonas Salk. He'd been developing it for about 2 years, and the spring of 1954 was when the field trials for this vaccine actually began, shots in arms. Thousands of kids, including Salk's own, were part of this first effort. Some received the vaccine, some received a fake shot, and some received nothing at all. And the start of this, the announcement of vaccine trials, as you can imagine, was a major, major milestone, a cause for celebration. It is one of those I remember where I was moments for, I think, an entire generation. I don't need to convince anyone listening now how good that kind of news can feel. And generally speaking, the vaccines were incredibly successful in knocking back polio over the next few years. But there was a rocky road ahead. Conspiracy theories, inequities in distribution, distrust of the vaccine, lots of things that sound familiar. So let's talk about this moment where the shots go into the arms and what came next with, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Jody.
And Kelly Carter-Jackson of Wellesley. Hello, Kelly.
Hey there.
Nikki, you want to start here and maybe let's just talk about this moment. Why Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty straightforward reason. That's where Jonas Salk was working as a researcher at the University of Pittsburgh. And so as he's finally developing this latest version of the vaccine, just using local kids as a way of seeing whether or not it works, which was something that was not without risk. I mean, there had been attempts to create polio vaccine for nearly 20 years. And one of the big stumbling blocks was that they would develop a vaccine. They would give it to kids, and a bunch of kids would get polio. They would die. They would be paralyzed. And so there was a real fear that if you didn't get this right, you were just going to exacerbate the problem.
Yeah, I feel like it's always, you know, noteworthy in some ways to sort of compare the anxiety or the fear that people had then is very similar to the anxiety and fear that people have now. And given that polio, you know, disproportionately impacted children, I think this is something that people wanted to make sure that they got right, because you could impact someone's life for the rest of their life starting at a very young age. And so the ways in which this becomes politicized, I think, too, is also really interesting.
Yeah. And I just want to sort of reiterate that this affects kids point. I mean, you know, I think I've probably said it on this show, but, you know, I think the big thing I think about with coronavirus is, oh, my gosh, imagine if this really affected kids. What would that be like? And, you know, you can look to polio. And as Nikki was saying, you know, we're talking not just about this thing shows up and then there's a 1 year rush. I mean, we're talking about an entire generation or two that's affected by this. And so this like combination of living with the fear of kids specifically, the kind of fear that brings, and over the course of 5, 10, 15, 20 years is like remarkable. And when you look at the development of the vaccine, like it just reinforces how much of a miracle it is that, you know, 10 months into the coronavirus, there was a vaccine, because as Nikki was saying, it was a decade of trying to find this. And Salk himself was kind of like, I get this weird impression, Nikki, that he was like freelancing a little bit for a couple years and making this happen and then trying it on. You know, it wasn't part of this like worldwide unified effort that we feel like we're seeing now around the coronavirus vaccine.
Yeah, it's so interesting because there was clearly a sense of urgency, especially by the 1950s when there's another big outbreak. There is this sense that we have to find a solution to this because it's our kids, but also this concern about, you know, again, trying these vaccines that, you know, that might not work, that might spread polio. And so there also wasn't the same kind of focus on like federally funded science. It's not going to be until the Cold War. I mean, this really is the moment when you start to see the kind of investment in science. But really, it's happening, you know, when John Kennedy comes around and starts talking about that the U.S. is lagging behind the Soviet Union. But in these very early Cold War years, there just isn't a tradition of the federal government investing in this kind of massive science-based program. And so, yeah, you end up with freelancers like Salk.
And then, Kelly, there's also, you know, I think an inequity element to this as well, both in the development of the vaccine and the distribution.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that has always gone hand in hand is race and public health. And so the ways that something like a pandemic or something like polio can play out with race, everything about this new vaccine gets racialized very quickly. And so there's fear about how will this impact Black children? Does this even impact Black children? When we think about the fact that the genesis for this vaccine started with the cells of Henrietta Lacks.
Yeah, I think this is really important, both that resistance to sharing anything about Henrietta Lacks's role in this, the idea that, quote unquote, Black cells, that there's a problem with that in the medicine. But there's also kind of a separate effort going on as well because of the segregation in medical science. So there's an effort going on at the Tuskegee Institute in order to both run tests, in order to make sure that the vaccine is safe for Black people, in order to understand polio's unequal outcomes. It's a really important moment, not just in, you know, medical science as the hero that saves the day, but in understanding what segregated medicine looked like.
You mentioned the Tuskegee Institute, and listeners may hear that word Tuskegee and medical research in the same sentence and think about those horrific government-run syphilis experiments. But this is other research taking place at Tuskegee, the historically Black college that has its own medical research department, Black scientists working from the cells of Henrietta Lacks, a Black woman. And this is one of the few places, as you pointed out, that is looking into disease and the Black community specifically. But of course, that was not really a story that was told widely at the time, if ever.
I mean, knowing that a Black woman's cells were instrumental in bringing about a cure, I think would have turned many people off, especially during, you know, the 1950s, where people believed that any sort of cross-contamination between the races would have been detrimental to their well-being. So this, not only does this get highly politicized, but also highly racialized in terms of how the vaccine rolls out. I think that both Black and white families have a real fear, even a legitimate fear, as to whether or not this vaccine will work. And I think part of the fear in the Black community is the fear of always being sort of experimented on, but also the overall fear of what are the long-term consequences of this and how will this, you know, play out.
You mentioned it in passing, Kelly, but like, I feel like I want to hit that note about the rumor that Black people couldn't get polio.
There was this myth, right, that Black people couldn't contract polio or were somehow resistant to polio, which is absolutely not true. But oftentimes we'll find that when it comes to public health and race, Black people get erased from the conversation. And so their numbers aren't tracked very well. Their diseases aren't treated at the same proportionate rates as their white counterparts. And so this becomes a real issue for Black people, for poor people to get access to the kind of healthcare that they need to prevent things like polio. But Black people absolutely got it.
I mean, it's very similar to what we are seeing today. I mean, I think it comes up in the school opening conversation as well, that because the experience of Black and brown people with the coronavirus isn't as visible in many white people's lives, you know, for white people who have been who have experienced the virus as less deadly, they just kind of ignore that experience, go with their own, and then those stories fall out. But then also, like, the necessary public health responses don't get folded in into the solution, because if you think of it as only a white problem, you're missing a big part of the public health equation.
And I will say that just like with coronavirus, Black people have always had to develop their own remedies. So when we think of George Washington Carver, who develops his own sort of peanut oil to serve as a remedy to polio, I know that Black circles in the Black community, people are always talking about taking ginger and garlic and, you know, mixing certain homemade remedies to combat the coronavirus. These traditions of finding your own remedy or creating your own remedy out of necessity or out of the neglect from the public health sphere is something that plays out today.
And again, a lot of that is a product of real distrust and a real lack of information. And as we're seeing today, there is rumors and misinformation, but there are also incidents of the vaccine not working as it should, and that can create all sorts of problems as well.
The vaccine accidentally contaminated a batch of live poliovirus in 1955, which later becomes known as the Qatar incident. But lots of people who experienced this particular live poliovirus died, and some people even became paralyzed. 51 people were actually paralyzed as a result of this exposure.
Yeah, and this is where I feel like the lack of a sort of steady governmental hand or unified hand, you know, whether it's government or some sort of public-private partnership or whatever, really lets incidents like that, which again, you know, when you put it in the larger context of a vaccination effort, you know, there, when you talk about something being 95% effective or whatever, or there are mistakes in science sometimes, but you know, but when there isn't that sort of steady hand on the tiller constantly reinforcing the importance of a program like this, then you let incidents like that, you know, they tap into an incredible distrust and fear and rumor. And we're seeing it now, you know, I mean, I think we're seeing it a little less now, but you know, you see these like tweets about two people got sick. Well, it's like two people got sick out of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. Like this vaccine is genuinely working. But when the process is fractured and there's a vacuum for misinformation or rumor, you know, then, you know, all these things play in.
Yeah, and it can be really easy to focus on the vaccine resistance, especially because something like the Qatar incident becomes sort of the origin story of the anti-vaxxer movement in a lot of ways. Yeah. But there really was a deep desire for this vaccine. People wanted it desperately. Mm. And this, too, becomes part of the conversation. How do you not only get the shot into as many arms as possible, but how do you make sure that that's done fairly? And there had been proposals to make this a free vaccine. And of course, it's immediately met with the bogeyman of socialized medicine and this idea that like the free market is going to be the best way to distribute this vaccine, even though that would mean really unequal outcomes for people who didn't have the resources to go to a doctor. At this point in time, like there were millions of Americans who'd never seen a doctor in their entire life. So the idea of being able to get this vaccine was a lot more difficult than you might think, especially without a program to make sure it got to the poorest Americans.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a really good point. I think it just highlights something, again, that we're still struggling with today, which is access. And, you know, what happens when elements of cures get privatized and whose hands they get into and how you decide who gets what and when. A lot of this comes down to like dollars and cents, unfortunately. Yeah. And that is something that we're still contending with today, believing that, you know, the wealthy will always have access to this medicine first and the poor will always have access last.
Yeah, I mean, you read some of these stories and, you know, there was a black market started to pop up in late 1954 into 1955, you know, price gouging, you know, people working their angles and again, it breaking out because there wasn't this sort of steady hand. But, you know, when you read how this played out, through 1954, you can see the vaccine rollout become this political football. And there's people in Washington saying, well, okay, you know, this should be our responsibility. And then other people are saying, no, let's kick it to the states. Like literally just using the exact same language we heard over the last year. Like, no, the states should take advantage of this. Or no, this should be private companies should take advantage of this, you know. And I think when a plan hadn't been developed, you know, over the course of years and a sort of fundamental decision about how this was going to get rolled out, it becomes this football. Compare that to other parts of the world in even, you know, even here in 1955, like in Canada where there was socialized medicine, like they got the polio vaccine to like basically everyone over the course of 1955 really efficiently. And again, we're seeing all that same sort of stuff play out today.
Yeah, and just to add one more note to what you're saying, Jody, one of the people who was the biggest advocate of, oh, let the states do it, let the free market do it, was the head of health, education, and welfare. So Aveda Kabi, who was the secretary of this department, she was one of the leading lights pushing away from government solutions, and she controlled the government department that could actually do something about distributing the vaccines.
Yeah. You know, in looking at this and thinking about this, I think that there's a way you could kind of argue that the polio vaccine distribution is like the origin story, big bangs for, you know, modern conservatism in many ways, because it just creates this incredible flashpoint, as you're saying, Nikki, about states versus federal government, socialization. You know, Ronald Reagan, as he's starting his political career, he really rails against socialized medicine, and it's come, it sort of builds on this, these questions that came out through the polio vaccine. And then obviously the like conspiracy theory, anti-vaxxer strain of it all. But like, you know, part of me is like, oh man, maybe it all started with the polio vaccine.
I would read an article about that.
Yeah. or listen to the end of a podcast about that.
Yes.
So we should, you know, we should come back around as we start to wrap up here by pointing out that the polio vaccine also was a miracle, right? And it really did knock back polio. And there's incredible stories of people, you know, obviously people avoiding it and people recovering from polio. You know, it's one of those diseases that I think defined an entire generation in the way that I think coronavirus is going to as well. But it also was a true miracle of modern science.
And the fact that no one gets polio today. I mean, and when we think about the fact that this has become virtually an extinct disease that would be incredibly difficult to contract, at least within, you know, developed countries, right? So when you think about the fact that this is something that millions of children had, and then by 1962, the number of cases are less than 1,000. Yeah. You know, we can't find someone that has polio today or see it as a real risk. And that's in a short amount of time. Within, you know, less than 10 years, it becomes completely eradicated. So that's incredible.
And you see just like these remarkable stories of people who either had it or overcame it, or, you know, stories of people getting vaccinated and avoiding it.
Yeah, I think one of the most remarkable stories is one I did like a book report on when I was in the third or fourth grade about Wilma Rudolph. Wilma Rudolph, the famous Olympian athlete, contracted polio when she was a child, when she was 5 years old. She wore braces on her legs until she was about 12 years old, and then goes on to become this famous track star and win all kinds of medals in the Olympics. So it does show you that even people who weren't able to receive the vaccine were in some ways able to overcome.
Yeah, I think that's such an important story to add in, because to the extent that people today are really aware of polio, I think they tend to think of Franklin Roosevelt, who dealt with the consequences of his polio and paralysis in his legs for the rest of his life. So to also throw in the story of a three-time gold medalist at the 1960 Olympics, it shows you a variety of experiences with this disease.
Yeah.
It's not many history stories that have a happy ending. So I think we should stop.
Oh, shoot. I was gonna complicate it with something, but no, maybe now I have to. Look, I was gonna complicate it slightly by pointing out something that I think is also another lesson for now, which is that as it became effective, the argument for it becomes less apparent, right? Mm-hmm. By definition, as fewer and fewer people have this, people feel less of that urgency. And I think that's something that's going to be an issue here, how there's going to be this first rush to the vaccine, and then there's going to be hard work as you get the communities that are most distrustful of it. And also people are just, there's less and less coronavirus and people are feeling less of that urgency. And I think you saw that with polio as well, which again reinforces just the need for like ongoing concerted work in order to really, you know, finish the job.
Well, you see that even with flu shot, right?
Like totally,
people, maybe I'll get it this year. Maybe I don't. I've gone even years without getting it, not intentionally. I just like, oh, snap, right. I didn't get a flu shot this year.
Right. Like, well, it's the, you know? It's the like, you know, I don't get the flu shot and I've never gotten the flu. It's like, well, because everyone else got the flu shot. You know? That's why you didn't get the flu. But, you know, so yes, tragedy of the commons, I think. Okay, we're going to leave it there. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter-Jackson, thanks to you.
Thank you.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Kala Nakua helps with our transcripts. You can find those at thisdaypod.com. Also on our website, you can get in touch with us and with any questions, comments, or suggestions about the show. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
We can all be proud of the soft vaccine brought about by American scientists and American giving.
Your child or any member of your family eligible for polio vaccine in your community should be vaccinated now. Vaccination now will save lives from death or paralysis this year. make use of increasing supplies of vaccine. Help your child grow up strong and straight, free from crippling polio.
Radiotopia.